Now let's do a switch back to the city of Washington, D.C., where preparations are underway for the inaugural ceremonies of President Eisenhower and Vice President Richard Nixon. I've reported to you on several occasions about the inaugural committee having invited the minister and representative of the Kadar government in Hungary and the ambassador from the same Soviet-Russian government that is conspiring in this Budapest slaughter to be honor guests at the president's inaugural ball a week from next Monday night. I suggested quite firmly, and I repeat the suggestion again, that if you, as a red-blooded American citizen, find that thought revolting and completely repugnant, you might start a deluge of letters and postcards of protest to the inaugural committee and insist that the invitations to those two be withdrawn. A tremendous number of listeners have done exactly that, as I know from the testimony of the carbon copies of such letters that are flooding my own mail. You may be interested to know what the inaugural committee is doing about them. I have before me a reply from the committee to a lady in Buffalo, New York, who wrote her protest to the committee on December the 30th. It's on the stationery of the inaugural committee, very flossy stationery. Robert V. is in Victor Fleming, chairman, and Louis T. Bruninger, executive vice chairman, and it reads as follows. First, the salutation, of course, then the body of the letter. Quote, this will acknowledge your letter of December the 30th protesting the invitation of diplomatic representatives of Russia and the satellite nations to the inaugural ball. Historically and traditionally, all chiefs of foreign missions with which the United States maintains diplomatic relations are invited to the inaugural ball. This in no way indicates that we subscribe to or approve of their political opinions or actions, but it is simply in keeping with the traditional protocol established by the Department of State. With good wishes, I am very truly yours, Carl L. Shipley, chairman of the inaugural ball committee. All of which brings us back to just where we started. One, the State Department has nothing to do with the inaugural ball. It is not an official function, but a private affair, privately financed by the sale of tickets. Two, what is the meaning of historically and traditionally? That simply means that someone started it once and it has continued ever since. And those were not days when things were happening, such as the conspiracy of mass butchery that is being enacted in Hungary today. Conditions and circumstances have changed, and the rules should be changed accordingly. Three, we shouldn't be recognizing either Russia or Hungary diplomatically anyway, because the governments of those two countries do not represent the people they purport to represent. If there must be some international dealings with these agents of tyrants, there should be some qualified form of relationship which does not require that we treat them like human beings or representatives of legitimate governments. And four, what is all this hogwash about not implying that we approve of their political opinions or actions? What's going on in Hungary is not an expression of political opinions or actions, and for a person in any responsible position to even use that language is terrifying. This is communist military aggression and enslavement and blood-bathing of innocent and helpless people whose crime is that they want to be free and have an end of being robbed and pillaged and murdered. Political opinions and actions, says the inaugural committee. Once again, after the last break, I'll repeat that address for you so that you might have a pencil and paper handy. I've had many requests from it for people who want to blow their tops on paper and who did from the carbons I've been getting. There's considerable speculation here as to what's going to happen to Republican National Chairman Leonard Hall after his resignation on February the 1st. Words being passed around in top administration circles that he will be given a top-ranking job in the administration itself. Ordinarily, the job would be Postmaster General, which is the usual line of succession from national chairmanships, but Postmaster General Arthur Summerfield is not expected to be replaced, or it might be the Attorney Generalship. The Attorney General being Mr. Hall being a former judge, but Attorney General Brownell apparently isn't entirely secure in that position, too. Major ambassadorships rarely go to anyone who is not independently wealthy, because such are the only people who can afford to foot the bills. But the only thing left would seem to be a place on the Supreme Court, and that it might be. I'll have more news for you now in just 1 minute.
The Marine Air Reserves have the responsibility of putting planes into the air, and this responsibility requires split-second timing, backed up by alert minds. If you young men of draft age are interested in becoming part of a quick-thinking team, then there's a place for you in the Marine Air Reserves. Yes, you can continue on with your present job and still become a member of the Marine Air Reserve Squadron located in or near your hometown. By attending weekend drills once a month, you'll soon acquire the traits that make a good Marine, and you'll be forming a habit of making decisions that will become essential to your work. And at the same time, you'll be shortening your obligated military service that every young man is faced with these days. Get these facts today by calling the Marine Air Reserve Unit at the Naval Air Station at Gros Isle, Michigan, and say, men, you'll be proud to serve with the Marine Air Reserves. Now back to Fulton Lewis, Jr.
That address, once again, for your letter of protest, if you desire to send one, it is the Inaugural Committee, Liberty Loan Building, 14th and D Streets, Southwest, that is D as in Donald, and it's Southwest, not Northwest, Washington, D.C. And if you want to address it personally to the chairman, his name is Robert, V as in Victor Fleming, and don't put it off. If you do, you might forget it. That's the top of the news as it looks from here.
Kraft presents Cedric Foster and his recorded commentary on the news. Here's today's fifth edition of the Kraft Five-Star News, brought to you by the Kraft Foods Company, who bring you that very special cheese, Cracker Barrel brand. The old-fashioned natural cheddar that's so fine, Kraft wraps it in double-strength aluminum foil. Now, Cedric Foster.
Early this morning, former United States Senator C. Whalen Brooks, Curly Brooks, died of a heart attack in Chicago. He had been fighting valiantly against a heart condition for several years. Although he had been in the hospital for 5 days, his death was unexpected. When the seizure took him, he went very quickly. His lovely and devoted wife, Mary, the daughter of former Senator Thomas from the state of Idaho, was at his side. When Curly Brooks died, a distinguished public servant passed from the American scene. Curly Brooks was a courageous man. At all times, fearlessly, he spoke his mind. That his voice was raised in behalf of conservatism and isolationism was due not to the fact that he was following a popular line in a section of the country, the state of Illinois, where he was born and reared. He had a deep and sincere belief that America should not become involved in European quarrels, and for that reason he espoused a cause of isolationism. But he was not a follower, he was a leader and a molder of opinion. Curly Brooks knew from personal experience what it was to go to war. He lost his brother in the First World War. He himself served in the United States Marines in the First World War. He rose from private to lieutenant, and for extraordinary heroism in action, Curly Brooks received the Distinguished Service Cross, the Navy Cross, the Croix de Guerre from France, and 6 Purple Hearts. He was a great American, standing for the right as he saw the right to be. Once the country was committed to a policy involving national security, he supported that policy with his whole heart, even though he might have bitterly opposed its enactment. Although we sometimes disagreed on national policy, he was my friend. Those who knew him as a friend loved him. His death leaves a great void. His place as Republican National Committeeman from Illinois is going to have to be filled in time to vote for the replacement of Leonard Hall as national chairman. Several persons have been mentioned as a successor to Mr. Hall. None is more able than Meade Alcorn from Connecticut, an outstanding attorney and leader of the Republican Party in Connecticut. Meade Alcorn is the logical choice to lead the party on the national level. He led his forces to a smashing victory last November in his home state, crushing the opposition under an avalanche of votes. He has drive, initiative, unflagging zeal for party politics, and a willingness to sacrifice himself. His was the guiding hand that organized the convention in San Francisco. The Republicans know this, and that is what makes me believe that Meade Alcorn will succeed Leonard Hall as national chairman of the GOP. This is Cedric Foster in Boston.
Last week, the House Foreign Affairs Committee heard testimony on President Eisenhower's new doctrine for the Middle East. Today, the Senate Foreign Relations and Armed Services Committees got into the react. Chairman Russell of the Armed Services Committee said he favored giving the president a free hand to use American troops to stop communist aggression. but could not understand why the Arab states, with their huge oil revenues, need financial and economic aid. Secretary Dulles replied that the Russians might suddenly cut off the oil, and complete anarchy would quickly follow. And when Chairman Green of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee warned against bypassing the United Nations, Mr. Dulles said the administration would rather refer the case to the United Nations before committing United States troops to the area, if possible. Secretary Dulles disagreed with Dean Acheson, who argued last week for a stronger, clearer Middle Eastern policy, but fewer and less belligerent words. Secretary Dulles, without mentioning Mr. Acheson by name, called the proposal quite irrelevant. What we must do is show we mean business and will resort to force to block communist aggression and subversion in the Middle East. To judge from the testimony to date, the Eisenhower Doctrine will prevent the kind of military attack for which the Soviet leaders have made no preparations visible to the naked eye, but offers no protection against the subversive tactics the Soviet leaders are already using with such effect. Neither arms nor money are of any avail. What's needed, as Life magazine recently pointed out in a leading editorial, is a vast regional plan to develop the water resources of the area, to provide irrigations to farmers and power to industry. Surely there must be some way for administration officials and the men who write the Life editorials to get together, seeing in most cases, or some cases, they're even the same men. Cairo newspapers, following as usual the Moscow line, have begun blasting away at President Eisenhower's plans for the Middle East. It's the first time since the president backed Egypt against Britain, France, and Israel 2.5 months ago that he has come under that kind of attack. But the fat is in the fire now, and all the Egyptian goodwill that the administration has to show for turning against its British, French, and Israeli allies was that 2.5 month armistice in the propaganda war. Ambassador Lodge has presented a new 5-point disarmament plan to the United Nations. First, agreement must be reached for all fissionable material to be produced under international control from now on. Second, if and when such agreement is reached, then and then only will a start be made to limit and eventually ban nuclear tests. Those that are made would take place under international supervision. Third, the United States would agree to the Soviet plan to limit American and Russian armed forces to 2.5 million men and British and French to 750,000. President Eisenhower's open skies inspection plan and Premier Bulganin's plan for ground inspection at key spots would also have to be incorporated in the deal. All guided missiles, including Earth satellites, would be placed under international control and an international system of inspection and control to guard against surprise attack would be established. The Russians will have no part of this except about the troop control. Humphrey Bogart has died of cancer in Hollywood at the age of 56. He is survived by his wife, Lauren Bacall, and their two children, Stephen, 8, and Leslie, 4. David Niven summed up Bogart as a man of enormous bark and no bite. Hardly anybody in either political party has cared or dared to criticize President Eisenhower's State of the Union message. Who, after all, can take exception to such statements as this at the beginning of the message? At no time in the history of the Republic have circumstances more emphatically underscored the need in all echelons of government for vision and wisdom and resolution. Or this, as the message came to a close. The great concept of the dignity of all men, alike created in the image of the Almighty, has been the compass by which we have tried and are trying to steer our course. The ravages of the drought in the Southwest states have led President Eisenhower to follow the example of other presidents before him and visit these stricken regions for himself. This gesture not only gives hope to the victims of the drought, it sets the stage for Congress to appropriate funds and take other measures to relieve suffering and prevent a repetition of this tragedy and waste. It was in the spirit of this State of the Union message, and in the spirit of other presidents before him, that the president set out on the flying trip he's now making. He has proved by deeds that his State of the Union message consisted of something more than empty words and pious declarations. But there is another situation to which many of the statements the president has made from time to time apply still more closely. And about this situation, the White House has as yet done and said nothing. No president since Woodrow Wilson has so often invoked Christian principles and sought to apply them to the high office that he holds. President Eisenhower has not only tried to set a national example by his regular church attendance each Sunday, his cabinet meetings open with a prayer. His news conferences, as well as his public addresses, are interlarded with quotations from Holy Writ. To some cynics, this may seem like a cheap and easy way to develop a reputation for virtue without having to do too much about it. But the president not only makes a conscious effort to apply the religious principles he invokes, these principles have yielded valuable political dividends. And nowhere has his doctrine of enlightened self-interest, applied Christianity, paid off more handsomely than in the field of civil rights. Millions of Negroes in the South as well as the North have recently shifted their allegiance from the Democratic to the Republican Party because of the stand the Republican Party has taken on civil rights since President Eisenhower entered the White House. But a time has now come when Negro citizens and others who have applauded the Republican record on civil rights expect a little more from a president who has so often proclaimed his devotion to the highest Christian principles. For instance, the Negro community in the city of Montgomery, Alabama, has for the past year boycotted the city buses by way of protest against racial discrimination. The men who led this boycott were ministers of various churches in Montgomery. One of them, the Reverend Martha Luther King, Jr., said he tried to combine the principles of Jesus with the techniques of Gandhi. Recently, these same ministers have been encouraged by a federal court decision against bus segregation to counsel the Negroes of Montgomery to occupy any seats they please in the city buses, but not to resist violence, to turn the other cheek, to meet hatred with love. At first, the tactic succeeded. It turned out there was little real opposition to desegregating the city buses. There was also wide respect for this Christian approach, especially from white members of the clergy. Lately, however, a few fanatics have resorted to violence, and the cry has gone up from the Negro ministers of Montgomery, begging President Eisenhower to speak out. Yesterday, the Reverend Ralph D. Abernathy led a prayer in the First Baptist Church that the president would speak just a word of hope in their behalf. And later, standing behind, or beside, rather, a stained glass window that had been wrecked by a dynamite blast, the Reverend Abernathy said, "We know that if the president would say just a word to the city, it would have great value." Will President Eisenhower speak that word? Will he live up to the code that he has himself proclaimed? No senator, Democratic or Republican, disputed Mr. Dulles on this point. But he did run into trouble when he also asked for favorable action on the president's request for authority to allocate economic and military aid as he sees fit to the tune of $400 million during the next 2 years. Yesterday, the secretary reversed all his predictions and reassurances of the past 4 years when he suddenly proclaimed that international communist military aggression in the Middle East now poses the most serious threat we have faced over the past 10 years. Today, he emphasized the economic emergency, which the threat of communist subversion has made more serious. The president, according to Mr. Dulles, must have a free hand to help the Middle East in the economic crisis that is now about to move in upon it. The tendency in Washington to stress the military threat to the Middle East and ignore the threat of economic collapse and political subversion did not originate with this administration. But the president and his secretary of state have done little to counteract this delusion that everything is military, nothing economic, and much to reinforce it. It is another case of following public opinion, not leading it, of accepting popular fallacies instead of challenging them. And if the president and his secretary of state are not getting now the quick and full support they feel the Congress should give them, the fault does not lie in their stars, but in themselves. Governor Alan Shivers of Texas has appointed 58-year-old William A. Blakely, another Eisenhower Democrat, to occupy the Senate seat of Price Daniel, who today became governor of Texas, succeeding Mr. Shivers. The Democrats expect Blakely to vote with them and thus leave them in control of the Senate. But Blakely has made no commitments, and within 90 days, Texas must elect a new senator to fill the remaining 2 years of Daniel's term. Only one Republican has entered the race, and if all the Democrats who plan to run carry out their intentions, the Republican could easily win and the Democrats thereby lose control of the Senate, no matter what Blakely does during the brief time he'll serve. At United Nations headquarters, the Asian-African bloc has agreed on a resolution that would condemn Israel for the slow withdrawal of its troops from Egypt. It would also call for an economic, financial, and military boycott of Israel by all United Nations members. Meanwhile, Israeli troops have hauled down their flag and pulled out of El Arash, the most important base in the Sinai Peninsula. This will probably not satisfy the Arab-Asian bloc, especially as the Israelis show no disposition to quit the Gaza Strip. The United States is expelling Major Yuri P. Krylov, assistant military attaché at the Soviet Embassy in Washington. The major improperly bought quantities of electronic equipment through American intermediaries and tried to purchase classified military information without success. The Soviet military had no comment, and Major Krylov has no future. Premier Kadar's pro-Soviet puppet government of Hungary is making the necessary preparations to receive Premier and Foreign Minister Zhou Enlai of Red China in the style to which he is accustomed. So far, the Kadar government has announced that 22 rebels have been sentenced to death under a new martial law that gives communist military courts power to pronounce sentences without any evidence or any trial. The rumor is going round that the victims of this new bloodbath will include Joseph Dudas, who was running the city of Budapest for the rebels at the height of the insurrection. Dudas has belonged to several parties, including the communists, and was sentenced to jail in 1948 by Matyas Rakosi, the notorious Stalinist boss who broke Kadar's body and spirit by prolonged torture. Communist police are still ferreting out machine gun nests in Budapest. Official radio announces that Red China will lend Hungary the equivalent of $50 million for reconstruction work. Meanwhile, the flow of refugees from Hungary to Austria continues at such a pace that the Austrian government, within a few days, will have no more money to pay for shipping any of these refugees to other countries, and it's already refusing to take back any refugees returned to Austria from other lands. To date, Austria has received more than 166,000 Hungarian refugees, of whom 73,000 remain on Austrian soil. The cost of caring for these refugees has now totaled $8.5 million, and Austria's financial condition is desperate as a result. Another Democratic member of Congress has warned that substantial numbers of communists have slipped into this country among the Hungarian refugees. Senator Olin Johnston of South Carolina today told the Senate Internal Security Committee that the United States is, as he put it, probably letting in some communists who will do nothing but spread communist activities here in America. And committee counsel Robert Morris presented a report on Gregory Lang, one of the Hungarian refugees who recently arrived at Camp Kilmer, New Jersey. According to Mr. Morris, Lang is a former Budapest lawyer who belonged to the Hungarian Communist Party from 1945 to 1948 and at one time served as a trusted clerk in the office of the Hungarian secret police. United States immigration officials now have Lang in custody while his case is being investigated. One masked Hungarian witness also testified at today's Senate Internal Security Committee hearing. He gave his name as Kalor Szabo, said that officials in the United States legation at Budapest knew that some Hungarian refugees belonged to the Hungarian secret police, to whom the Americans fed fake information that the secret Hungarian agents fed back to their superiors in the belief they were tapping some inside information. Szabo named four of these suspected secret agents, one of whom joined him in his attempted escape. Szabo made it. The other man was caught by the Russians. It's hard to see what service the Senate Internal Security Committee is performing for the government of the United States or for the great majority of bona fide Hungarian refugees by revealing such inside information as this in the workings of our security system in Budapest. It's easy to see, on the other hand, how helpful this kind of publicity could be to the Soviet leaders and to their stooges in Hungary. As for Senator Johnston's charge that some of these Hungarian refugees are communists, it's old stuff, irrelevant, and no surprise to anybody. Democratic Representative Water of Pennsylvania, co-author of the restrictive McCarran-Water Immigration Act, has already made the charge. Naturally, these Hungarian refugees include some former communists. It is no secret that most of the leaders of the Hungarian revolt, including Premier Imre Nagy, were communists. Indeed, if they had not been communists, their revolt would not have made the progress it did. What happened in Hungary and in Poland, too, is that many of the most militant communist leaders, most of the outstanding students and workers, and the great bulk of the armed forces joined the anti-communist, anti-Russian rebellion. Of course, the small minority who continued to take orders from Moscow has tried to infiltrate the refugee camps, and some have probably made their way to the United States. But our immigration authorities check all arrivals carefully, and before any gain American citizenship, they must be checked many more times. The risk that some few of them may be communists is far less than the risk of not accepting any refugees at all. In the eyes of the world and in our own eyes, we cannot do less than we're now doing for these Hungarian refugees, especially when so many West European nations who can ill afford the effort are doing more. Vice President Nixon, the man who owes his big political break to the fact that he cracked the Alger Hiss case, is not likely to turn soft on communism at this stage of his career. And when Mr. Nixon visited the Austro-Hungarian border just before Christmas and watched some of these refugees make their escape to freedom, he declared that he could see no significant security risk in permitting them at least to enter this country and then be checked here. Senator Johnston's notion that the communists have infiltrated the refugee program in order to spread communist activities in the United States also misses the mark. The Communist Party of the United States has failed dismally in its efforts to subvert America and the American people. What chance have a handful of Hungarian refugees got of toppling our government? Insofar as communist agents have infiltrated the ranks of the refugees, their purpose is to spread confusion among the refugees and sabotage the program from within, which isn't so different from what certain self-appointed snoopers are doing in the name of Americanism.